The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
It's great to be at the Free Library. It's great to be at a library, because libraries are just such essential parts of civic life, and it's really good to know that the library here in Philly is so vital and so vibrant, and that it's actually expanding. So I wish it all the best in that campaign. I'm going to talk a bit about Interesting Times and read a couple of passages from it, not too much, and then we'll spend most of the rest of the time talking among ourselves. We'll have questions. So this book is essentially a record of a particular era. It's already now, to me, has the feel of a historical era. It's got that bit of distance, although it hasn't ended, because eras never really end. But it begins on the morning of September 11th, 2001, and it ends on the night of November 4th, 2008. The essays and articles in this book cover those seven really crowded years. And the title comes from the ancient Chinese curse, which turns out to be apocryphal, unfortunately. May you live in interesting times. And we have. I see those 7 years as the time when America was jolted back into history. We had been essentially giving ourselves a pass since the end of the Cold War. We had thought that our obligations, our connections, in a sense, our involvement in history had ended with the Cold War, and that we were then free to entertain ourselves, to make money, to invent wonderful gadgets and products, but that the world was no longer our problem. And one thing that the terrible events of that morning made clear was that the world was our problem and that we were the world's problem, that there was an inextricable relationship. And it, in that sense, for all the terribleness and tragedy, there was, to me, an opportunity that morning. That was my first reaction, maybe second reaction. The first was shock and horror. But the next day, on September 12th, I stood in line in Brooklyn for about 6 hours, waiting with hundreds of other New Yorkers to give blood. And, of course, they didn't need our blood because there was no one to receive it, unfortunately. But during those 6 hours, I had a number of conversations with people in that line that stretched all the way around a city block. And that conversation is described in the first essay in Interesting Times. And what I found was it's as if everyone had woken up. It's as if 9/11 had been a kind of horrible, gigantic wake-up. And people were talking very personally about their own lives as if they had realized they weren't living the way they wanted to, or they wanted to change their lives. An investment banker told a policeman who said, "You're in shock." The banker said, "I'm not in shock. I've never been more conscious in my life." And that was, to me, the collective psychological effect that 9/11 had. And there was a period, and it's now almost impossible to recall it, when the shock of those events sort of forced Americans to look at the world in a new way, to ask questions about the world. Who are they? Why do they hate us, in that famous question? But maybe more interesting and deeper questions as well. I remember Oprah had an entire show devoted to Islam, which is not something that would have happened before 9/11. And suddenly, we, in a sense, I think, became part of the world and history again. And that should have been a good thing. To me, there was an opportunity. There was a certain possibility. Unfortunately, as the years went by, it was squandered, it was wasted, and the trajectory that this book covers is of that possibility and how America's reaction to it missed the chance, I think, to respond and re-enter the world in a productive way. But the period ends with this remarkable event in our own lives, the election of Barack Obama, which showed that, you know, we were capable of surprising the world after all. We were capable of self-criticism. We were capable of self-renewal. And so it's not an entirely dark story. Some of the pieces in Interesting Times are about the major events, sort of the mainstream narrative of those years, which obviously is 9/11, the response of the Bush administration in its foreign policy, the Iraq War, and the aftermath of the Iraq War, and the election of 2008. Those are sort of to me, and the financial crisis that coincided with the election. Those are like the big world-changing, world historical events of this seven-year period, and there's lots in the book about them. I wrote a book a few years ago called The Assassin's Gate, which is entirely and specifically about the Iraq War. And so I didn't want to duplicate that. So there's nothing in this book that uses the material from The Assassin's Gate. So if you read straight through it, there's a kind of a gap between the period before the Iraq War and the later years of the Iraq War, which is a gap that's filled by The Assassin's Gate. But I was talking to Arthur before coming on tonight, and the one advantage and disadvantage of a book like this is that it captures the author's thinking and sort of the mental atmosphere of a time as it happens in real time. The temptation to revise when you put a collection together is great because we're wrong about as often as we're right. Not necessarily wrong in big ways, but just wrong in we have limited information. We don't really understand what's happened, especially something that was as new as 9/11. 9/11 was a new thing for Americans, and to make sense of it took years, I think. And some of the essays in this book show me trying to make sense of 9/11 and the aftermath and getting some of it wrong or having insufficient amount of information or having a mental construct that was a little bit off. But I think it's valuable to see that because it reminds us, first of all, of how limited our vision is at any given moment of history. And it also puts you back in the experience itself, as only journalism can do. This is not history. I'm not writing with the advantage of years of perspective. This captures my reporting and my thinking as it unfolded. And I think there's a sort of value to that, even though it exposes the writer to, you know, to the charge of having gotten things wrong. So one thing this book is a record of what it was like to be alive on the morning of 9/11 in New York, as I was, and in the months afterward, to think through the war in Iraq before it happened and to weigh the arguments about it and to try to imagine what the post-war might be like, to weigh the rhetoric versus the reality of the Bush administration and its evolving foreign policy, and to try to make sense of the phenomenon of Barack Obama, who just a few years, you know, ago, you know, hardly any Americans had heard of. And his trajectory is one of the most astonishing things in our recent history. But I'm giving you a slightly distorted idea of what's in this book, because most of the book is not about the big events, the headlines, or the main actors in these dramas. Most of the book is about people and places that are rather obscure, and they're out of the headlines. A few examples. There's a long essay about the city of Lagos, Nigeria, and what it means to live in a megacity, a city of 16 million people, which is becoming a feature found all across the globe now. These huge cities where more and more people are emptying out the countryside and coming for work and in many cases not finding it. There's a couple essays about civil wars in West African countries, Sierra Leone and Ivory Coast. There's a long piece about Burma. And in these cases, I found myself when I traveled to these countries always gravitating toward ordinary people, not toward VIPs. Because if you sit with a student in Rangoon or with a young man carrying an AK-47 in Ivory Coast and really listen, I find you get deeper into the truth of what's happening in his country or her country, the more permanent truths, than you do from interviewing leaders. And so I spent most of my time and energy finding those characters whose smaller story illuminated the larger story. And this was made possible by the simple fact that I was working, and most of these pieces were published in a magazine called The New Yorker, which does a particular thing in journalism that's, it's so rare now it's on the endangered journalism list. And it is endangered. I'm not sure that there will always be a New Yorker. I'm not sure that there will always be what is called long-form narrative journalism, which is what I do. This is journalism that devotes 10, 12, 15,000 words to a subject, that tells the story not as a news story, but more using some of the techniques of fiction, although, as the fact-checking department will tell you, it had better all be true, that uses characters and scenes and long description as well as analysis to create a narrative form, which I think is a form that makes it easier and more pleasurable for readers to go to another country that they might not have wanted to travel to. And to meet people they might not have known that they were going to be interested in. And it's a form that I think allows for a deeper truth than you get from the soundbite that is mostly what you can find on TV and even in some newspaper journalism. And it's a privilege and a kind of a rare luxury these days to have a magazine willing to spend the money and the time and to devote the magazine space and to take the chance to send a writer to an obscure place without any clear idea of what the story is going to be, because that's the sort of high-wire act that happens over and over again. I don't know who I'm going to meet. I don't know what they're going to tell me, and I don't know how they're going to illuminate the subject of a civil war or a mega city or a sclerotic dictatorship or poverty or whatever the subject is. And there's always a moment when I'm on the airplane headed home and the wheels lift off and I suddenly panic that I didn't get it. I didn't talk to the right people. I didn't hear the right things. I should have gone to that town that I was told was a pretty interesting place. And the reason why that panic happens is because I don't have a formula. I don't have a blueprint for how to do it. I have to reinvent it every time. So a good deal of the book is about these places that might even seem like backwaters. Sudan is another one. And people who are not known to you. But a theme that kept coming up when I was reporting in places like West Africa and also in places like southeastern Ohio was the incredible power of the global media, which is a new thing, another new thing. 25, 30 years ago, I was a Peace Corps volunteer in a little village in Togo in West Africa. There was no global media. I to get a letter home took 6 weeks. I couldn't call my family on the cell phone. There was no email. I was isolated. And what that meant was I was truly left to my own devices and to fall back on the village itself that I was living in. It was immersion in a way that we're not really even capable of anymore, because there are electronic distractions that are constantly pulling us out of the experience. Well, that world is gone, including in those villages in West Africa. And instead, the world that young people especially live in places like West Africa, is a world in which they're constantly being bombarded with sounds and images and words from satellite TV, from pirated DVDs, from the internet. And so there's, I think, an illusion that the world is smaller, that we're all sort of living with the same reality, and that we know each other. But the reality is quite different, because even though we all live with the same world of global media, although there are different media in different parts of the world, we still live local lives. We still are parochial. Our context is still the thing that matters most. The images and sounds of the global media are very shallow and superficial compared to the deep texture of the lives that we actually live. So we have our rooted local lives, which in the case of a West African 16-year-old is a really hard life. No job prospects, probably a war going on nearby, maybe a war in which this kid is going to end up fighting because of the lack of job prospects. But at the same time, this veneer of international connectedness, which gets applied in weird ways. How does a kid in West Africa imagine his way into a world in which a war in Iraq or a presidential election in the U.S. or a rap artist in New York or a basketball player in Los Angeles is what he's seeing all the time? In some ways, it has nothing to do with his life, but in other ways, it's this becoming sort of the common currency of his mental world. How to make sense of that? Well, I got quite interested in the way in which especially young people in those parts of the world try to place themselves in this world of global media. What's my place here? Well, their place is very tenuous. In a sense, they don't have a place. The global media doesn't know them. They know the global media, and they know a lot more about us than we know about them because they're watching us on TV all the time. And so the effort to find an identity in a world that's shaped by these images leads to some unexpected, unintended, and in some ways perverse effects. My basic feeling is, and it's a theme of some of the essays in Interesting Times, my basic feeling is, the global media have made the world, for now at least, a meaner place, a less tolerant place, a less informed place in some ways, a less enlightened place, because the images that we have are extreme. They're usually violent. They don't tell the deeper story that you may need 10 or 15,000 words in a magazine to tell. Instead, they tell a flickering and fragmented story, which seems either bizarre or threatening, or, and so the mind looks for explanations, and those explanations are often conspiratorial in nature. And so instead of a kind of gradual enlightenment and understanding, which is what Ted Turner had hoped to achieve when he first invented CNN, instead, to me at least, has filled our heads with a lot of pictures that have made us in some ways more suspicious of the world, more suspicious of each other, and maybe less willing to really listen. So it's a strange twist on what should have been a wonderful new era. But it's something I kept running into everywhere I went, that a dominant force in anyone's life in any part of the world is the media that are coming from outside and that are just everywhere in their minds, but nonetheless have not bridged the gap between what they see and want, because a lot of this is only encouraging aspiration and desire, and then what they can have, what their lives can afford them. And that gap is a very wide gap. And to me, it's a dangerous gap. I'm going to read a passage from an essay on the Civil War in Ivory Coast, which came out in 2003 in The New Yorker. And it describes a trip I took to the interior of Ivory Coast. Before the Civil War broke out, the journey from Bouake to Mon, the biggest town in the West, took 8 or 9 hours. It took me 2 days because I had to pass through at least 50 roadblocks. In some places, there was a roadblock every quarter mile. They were makeshift affairs, a tree limb, pieces of junked machinery, concrete blocks. The boys on guard roused themselves from the shade of a tree. When they noticed a white face in the car, they put on angry expressions and went back to grab their AK-47s. Glowering behind sunglasses, they stalked over to the car, fingers on their triggers. Around their necks hung leather thongs with polished wooden or stone amulets, which they believed made them bulletproof. Carved fetish figurines stood guard alongside the roadblock. The boys ordered me to open the trunk. They pretended to search inside. They demanded to see my travel permit. A standoff. Everything was in order, but they hadn't given the signal to go, and they had the guns. This last detail made all the difference, yet I found it hard to accept the obvious power relation. Most of them looked the age of the middle school village boys I had taught 20 years ago in Togo. Those boys had called me Monsieur and left presents of papaya at my door. It was as if I had come back to the region to find all my students armed and snarling, ordering me to get out of the car. So I tried to talk my way through the roadblocks in the old, jokey Peace Corps way. And it usually worked. The boys' faces softened. The barked orders turned into requests for cigarettes or money or aspirin, which were only half serious, and then even a bit sheepish. And as the car started rolling forward, we exchanged a thumbs up, and a boy began giving me breezy compliments. If you Americans were here, we'd already be in Abidjan, as if the guns had just been props and everything were friendly between us. But the farther west I drove, past the ripe anacard fruit trees that no one was tending and the storehouses of cotton that couldn't be sold and the carcasses of vehicles that the rebels had wrecked and abandoned, the less useful my Peace Corps skills became. In Mon itself, picturesquely nestled in a ring of steep green mountains with waterfalls, the boys at the roadblocks, drunk or high, muttered about stealing the car. Pickup trucks bristling with Liberians carrying rocket-propelled grenade launchers slalomed wildly through the rebel army's obstacle courses. The walls of government buildings were bullet-riddled, and the freshly turned mass graves gave off a sharp smell. It was hard to tell who was in charge of Mon, the rebel commanders or their underage Ivorian and Liberian recruits, who, according to townspeople, were becoming indistinguishable. In the middle of town, the young rebels hung out at a maquis, or open-air eatery, called the Turbo, which smelled of porcupine stew. The youngest I saw, toting his AK-47, was no more than 9. I ordered a plate of rice and looked around. A boy with a red check keffiyeh on his head was staring straight ahead, filled with some private rage. Draped around the necks of other boys were leather clubs or sheathed knives or bandoliers. There was no one over 30 in sight. At midday, a group of 4 Liberians arrived and sat down at a table. The young men, who propped their weapons between their legs, began making their way through a bottle of Mangustan's rum. Their names were Shah, Shalah, Johnson, and Romeo. Shalah wore an American flag bandana, Rambo style. Shah, the most intoxicated of the group, lifted his shirt to show me his wounds. I asked how much he was paid for his services to the rebels. The cause is much more important than pay, Shah said. I don't appreciate pay. Well, what was the cause? Peace and unity in Africa, he said. After the war, Shah said, he wanted to go to New York and become an American Marine and learn to fly helicopters and use heavy weapons. I love America, he slurred, making an effort to lean forward. America is my culture. He waved his glass at the others. All of them love America. Romeo's glass fell to the floor and shattered. He stared at the fragments without moving. Johnson told the waitress that they would pay for it. Romeo slouched, sunk in a dark mood. A few months earlier, a recruiter had come to a refugee camp along the Liberian border and persuaded Romeo to join the rebels. There was no better offer on the horizon. He said, I want something because I don't want to be suffering. I don't have nowhere to go. Someone say, take money, go to war. You will not go there? You will go. He turned his dead-eyed stare on me. If you can't pay the young stuff, the war will go all over the world. The war will enter America. Let me tell you today, because you don't give them money. The man we want to see is bin Laden. We want to see him, to join him, because he can pay revolutionaries. You think you can get pay for this? Romeo held up his left calf to show me a bullet wound. You can't. Bin Laden can pay it. I had seen bin Laden's face painted on the side of a rebel vehicle. Some fighters wore T-shirts with bin Laden's face and Bush's face side by side. In this part of the world, there was no ideological contradiction. Both men stood for power. At a hospital in a town not far from Mon, an Italian doctor named Albert Brizio described the imagery of this war as, quote, a perverse effect of globalization, adding, it's what I call the Liberianization of war. Brizio had seen the effect in other African countries. Young fighters styling themselves after performances, often brutal ones, that they'd seen on TV or in movies. He said, it allows people to see events or situations they would never have thought of, and they imitate them. These situations have always been contagious, but then you had contagion by contact. Now you have contagion by media. And just skipping a bit, for the young people in Ivory Coast, their heroes are American celebrities, local warlords, gangsters, and demagogues. In the cities and the ragtag armies, they live in a society consisting of only the young, tempted and tormented by images and words from elsewhere, trapped in a money economy with nothing to sell. They have no ready way of realizing their desires, but they can't go back. To some hard-headed observers in the West, they are loose molecules, mindless forces of anarchy or a new primitivism. In fact, the opposite is true. The struggle in Ivory Coast, and perhaps in other parts of Africa, is recognizable as the unlovely effort of individuals to find an identity and a place in a world that has no use for them. In Abidjan, I spoke with Ruth Marshall Frattani, a researcher with the French journal Politique Africaine. She said, the gap between aspirations and possibilities, I think that gap has widened incredibly in the last 15 years. Access to global images has increased it amazingly. The phrase she borrowed to describe the situation of the young Africans I had met was lèche vitrine, window licking. It isn't window shopping, she explained. That means you can go in and buy. This is just licking the window. And basically, that is this generation's experience. Everybody wants to get a part of the action. They have these aspirations, and they're not prepared to give them up. Politics is one way, religion is another, and war is another. So there you have, in the long-form narrative style that The New Yorker allows and even encourages, a picture of a perverse effect of globalization. And we now have a president who is essentially trying to reintroduce us to the world. He's taking trips to foreign countries, showing respect, showing that we're willing to listen. We're not there just to give marching orders. To me, a necessary act of recovery from a period when America's reputation around the world plummeted. But this portrait suggests that the world is a more complicated place than we know, and people's feelings about their own lives and about us are not so simple, and they're not so rational, and they're not so easy to align with the way we want to be seen or the way we see the world. And that's not only because of this gap, as I was told, between aspirations and possibilities, but that's a big part of it. We may think that by being pleasant and nice and polite again, we're going to make friends. But what if what people around the world want is not for us to be nice and polite, but to have what we have, which they see all the time, with a sheet of plate glass between them and it. It's a situation that creates a kind of almost psychosis, I think, when the world that you see in images is so inaccessible to you, and yet you're surrounded by it all the time. And that's something that doing this kind of journalism allows you to see. It's very hard to write about that. It's a complicated, subtle subject, and I don't know how you would do it in a three-minute TV piece or a newspaper story, but you can do it if you have 10 or 15,000 words and if you can tell a story with a scene like the one that I just described. And so for that reason, I think The New Yorker played an important role in that period of 2001 to 2008 because it allowed for a kind of journalism that got beneath the bewildering and in some ways crazy-making barrage of images, mostly violent ones, that we were all subjected to during those years. I'll just read one more thing and then turn to your questions. This is a passage, just to let you know, this is not only about the effect of these images in other countries. It's also about us. And there's four pieces at the end of the book about last year's campaign, and one of them is about Obama's difficulty in closing the deal with a certain kind of voter came to be called the white working class, white voters, you know, making, say, less than 50,000 a year, whatever you want to call it. It was the group he had the hardest time winning over. He lost primaries in Kentucky and West Virginia by incredible margins because that group was more resistant to his appeal than others. And I went to Ohio, to southeastern Ohio, which is Appalachia, to find out how he was seen in that part of the country and what ideas voters there had. And it turned out that in some ways they reminded me a little bit, I don't want to draw the analogy too much, a little bit of those kids in Ivory Coast, because they too were in a kind of forgotten corner of America. I mean, the generation after generation in that part of Ohio had been living without employment, essentially on welfare, and had was in a pocket of Ohio that had been completely bypassed by whatever prosperity. And Ohio itself, of course, is now suffering a great deal. And yet, because of the Internet and satellite TV and network TV, they had access to the same news, the same language that anyone else following the campaign had. And so in some ways, their situation reminded me a little bit of what I saw in West Africa. So just a short passage from that essay. Gloucester, a coal mining town with a population of fewer than 2,000 and falling, lies hidden amid the gentle slopes and thick woods of southeastern Ohio's Appalachian Hills. If the state is dying, Gloucester was long ago left for dead. Over the past few decades, it has lost its Baptist church, grocery store, railroad depot, parking meters, four car dealerships, 10 of its dozen bars, and crucially, all but one of its deep mines. It's become the kind of town where several generations of white families live on welfare and marijuana is the local cash crop. I was given a tour by Bob Cotter, who is 74, and Pete Morris, who's 71, both retired from the post office. We walked in a warm drizzle along Main Street, which was nearly deserted, with a few parked cars and no pedestrians. Half the storefronts were shuttered, although a local citizens group had arranged hand-painted furniture and traditional quilts in the show windows of some of the vacant stores. It looked as if nothing had been built since the 50s. In the middle of town stood a prominent three-story brick building with the words Sam and Ellen's Wonder Bar, home of the Wonder Dog, painted across an exposed side. Morris had once owned the bar before selling it to his cousin in 1971. Now it was boarded up. Farther down the street, a hotel, a restaurant, and a two-lane bowling alley had been demolished, leaving a wood-strewn lot. Every morning at 7, Cotter and Morris had coffee at Bonnie's Home Cooking on Main Street across from the gas station. The menu was scrawled in magic marker across a whiteboard, and almost nothing cost more than $5. On the morning I visited, a dozen men and women came in for their coffee and eggs. One of them, a retired Union coal miner, was identified to me as if he were a rare species of bird. Three people, including Morris, expressed reluctant support for Obama. The 9 or 10 others were roughly split between voting for McCain and sitting it out. Dave Herbert was a stocky, talkative building contractor in an Ohio State athletic jersey. At 38, he considerably lowered the average age in Bonnie's. "I'm self-employed," he said. "I can't afford to be a Democrat." Herbert was a devoted viewer of Fox News and talked in fluent sound bites about McCain's post-convention bounce and Sarah Palin's executive experience. At one point, he had doubted that Obama stood a chance in Gloucester. He said, "From Bob and Pete's generation, there are a lot of racists. Not out and out, but I thought there was so much racism here that Obama'd never win." Then he heard a man who freely used the N-word declare his support for Obama. That blew my theory out of the water. A maintenance man at the nearby high school, who declined to give his name, said that he had been undecided until McCain selected Palin to be his running mate, which swung his support to Obama. "So you're a sexist more than a racist," Herbert joked. "I just think the guy Obama picked would do better if he got assassinated than McCain's if he died of frickin' old age in office," the maintenance man said. Four women of retirement age were sitting at the next table. All of them spoke warmly of Palin. "She'd fit right in with us," Greta Jenis said. "We should invite her over." None of them had a good word to say about Obama. "I think he's a radical," a white-haired woman who wouldn't give her name said. "The church he went to, the people he associated with, you don't see the media digging into that." I don't know what she had been watching. "I don't know anyone who's for Obama," said Jenis, a Democrat who supported Hillary Clinton and who won't vote in November. "If they are, they don't say it because it would be unpopular," an elderly former teacher named Marcella said. That had not been true of Bill Clinton, Al Gore, or John Kerry, she added. "I think the party-line Democrats are having a hard time with Obama," Bobby Dunham, a retired fourth-grade teacher, told me. "When I asked if Obama's health care plan wouldn't be a good thing for people in Gloucester, she said, 'I'll believe it when I see it. If it's actually happening, I'd say that's good.' But she and the others had far more complaints about locals freeloading off public assistance than about the health insurance industry and corporations. Dunham declared her intention to write in a vote for either Snoopy or T. Boone Pickens. "I'm not going to vote for a Republican. They've had their chance for the last 8 years, and they've screwed it up," she said. "But I really just don't trust Obama. He only says half-truths. He calls himself a Christian, but he only became one to run for office. He calls himself a black, but he's two-thirds Arab." I asked where she had learned that. "On the Internet." And just skipping a bit. In the static-filled bedlam of viral emails, cable news square-offs, mangled media clips, fake news websites, political ads, and malicious rumors, with a new lie popping up somewhere every hour, the Obama campaign faces the nearly impossible task of putting out stories before they spread across a political landscape that is often dry tinder for them. In Eau Claire, Wisconsin, Tom Giffey, the editorial page editor at the Leader Telegram, described the profusion of cut-and-paste emails that his page received during the campaign. He said, "In the old days, there were Republican or Democratic newspapers, but there was more of a level playing field, and both sides had to argue from the same facts. Now we're in an age when you can simply reinforce your own viewpoints. It's hard to have a discussion of the facts when you're dealing with two separate sets of facts, two sets of talking points that came down from on high. With the Internet, all of us were going to be content producers, but it's become an echo chamber." Unquote. As Dave Herbert, the building contractor at Bonnie's Home Cooking, put it, partisanship has crept into every crease in this country. In 2008, a customer at a breakfast spot in Appalachia or a worker at a union office in Columbus is able to repeat the latest dubious campaign sound bites within days, if not hours. Everyone hates the media, and everyone sounds like a talking head. So that's a few tastes of interesting times, and now I'm here to try to answer whatever questions you might have. Thank you. And there are microphones going around the room, so just raise your hand and I'll call on you. Yes, sir. Wait for the mic, though.
You were bringing up a point about foreign policy. We had, it seems, more of a provocative foreign policy. We don't have as much of a foreign policy like that now. Is it too soon to judge how well our foreign policy, because there's so much up in the air right now, and and along with that, because we're not provocative, we're asking the world to kind of go along with us in certain ways, but how much cooperation really is there out there?
Well, yeah, I think you're making a good point. I mean, Bush had a doctrine. He announced it as a doctrine, and it was a sweeping, total doctrine that included everything. It was essentially about the great struggle of freedom versus terrorism, and that divided the world, and you were on one side or the other. It was a kind of a bipolar, Cold War-style global struggle. And I think in retrospect, that looked like an overstatement of the world of that 9/11 created. And it was a dangerous overstatement because it led us to misunderstand the true nature of things and to take actions that were based on a construct rather than on reality and to plunge into places that we really didn't know because local reality is always more complicated and more stubborn than the ideas of, you know, smart people in places like Washington. I think Obama is trying to avoid a doctrine. I think he has presented himself as a pragmatist who, instead of describing the world in simple terms, is interested in solving some stubborn problems that went neglected in the last decade. Nuclear proliferation, global warming, and other issues that he doesn't talk about as much, but that he has brought up, like poverty, and also terrorism, which is a big part of his foreign policy, but not, he's retired the phrase war on terror. You don't hear that anymore. And I think that in as much as our language controls the way we think, that was the right thing because that phrase had led our thoughts in the wrong direction. But what Obama's now finding out, I think, is that simply saying we're back, we're listening, we respect you, we want a relationship, and his phrase is always based on mutual interest and mutual respect, that doesn't get you very far. Because, you know, other countries may well say, well, it's good to be talked to this way, it's good to feel that we're being listened to, but in fact our interests and yours are very far apart. And your desire to align us with your interests isn't gonna get you much. I think he found that when he went to China this week. And I think his Iran policy is in danger of coming up against that wall, because what if Iran isn't interested in a deal? Obama is a supremely rational man, and there's a sense that rational people can agree. I think that's his political style, too. You don't make unnecessary enemies. You assume good faith on the part of your opponent, and you believe that in the end, we can all come to some kind of agreement, even if it's an agreement to disagree, and we can do it in a civil way. That is the political style that I think was so enormously appealing to Americans after the corrosive divisiveness of the last couple of decades. But I think he's found out both at home and abroad that it takes, as I said earlier tonight, it takes two to tango. He reached out to the Republicans on domestic policy only to find out that there were maybe one or two of them interested in reaching back. And in foreign policy, it's as if, you know, having returned to our senses and the world, you know, breathing a sigh of relief and giving us a Nobel Peace Prize for it, that kind of doesn't get you as far as Obama wants to go. And instead, we have reemerged into a world in which we are no longer the unipolar power. There are different centers of power. China's the obvious rising power, and we are much weaker than we were in 2001. Our ability to leverage our political changes of the last year and our diplomacy into real changes in the behavior of other countries is more limited than we would like to think. And one price we're paying is Obama has muted talk of human rights. He doesn't like to hammer on it. I think he's calculated that that talk can be destructive. It backfires if the world thinks that we're haranguing them and telling them to be like us and giving orders. Bush used that language in a way that tainted very valuable words like democracy. So Obama has retired those words for now. But there's a cost for that. And, for example, in Iran, the cost is it looks as if we are being given no sort of bargaining room by the regime. But meanwhile, we have not shown ourselves to be friends of this remarkable opposition movement in Iran, who's taking to the streets in June, you know, was one of the really hopeful events across the world this year. So we've lost, in a sense, the trust of small d Democrats in places like Iran without gaining anything from our attempts to cut a deal with the regime. So right now, a year in, or less, a little less than a year in, I think Obama's going to have to start thinking about Plan B. And how you do that, I don't know, but that's where we are. There was a hand. Yeah. Yes, you.
Yeah. Well, thanks for coming, first of all. You mentioned at the beginning of your talk that after 9/11, there was an opportunity for this country to change, but was lost. What happened and why? And the follow-on is, we are in the middle of another crisis, this financial or economic crisis, and yeah. What do you think is going to happen with this one? Thanks.
Yeah. Well, I think that to put it really simply, 9/11 gave our leadership the idea that we had the right to remake the world in a way that made us safer, in their view. Instead of thinking that our own behavior needed to be on trial every bit as much as the behavior of whether it's terrorists or tyrants around the world. In other words, our democracy was not in good health on 9/11. I think it had been, there had been plaque building up in the arteries for quite a while. And Bush thought that he was Winston Churchill or Franklin Roosevelt summoning healthy democracies to a global struggle. And instead, his foreign policy, which was hugely ambitious, it was sort of Wilsonian in the level of the rhetoric, almost evangelical, crusading rhetoric, was totally at odds with his domestic policy. He never asked the country to sacrifice. He never suggested that, you know, Americans other than the volunteer army would have to pay a price. In fact, he told us the opposite. I think that was part of the missed opportunity. It made people skeptical. It made people cynical. It seemed as if some people were going to do well while a handful of people carried the whole burden. I think it made some people in the military cynical about us civilians and our willingness to share part of the burden. So I think even though the language was pitched at this Liberty Bond kind of level, where were the dollar a year men? Instead, we had Halliburton. And so there was no effort to make our democracy worthy of carrying the flag of democracy, which was the flag that Bush had in his hand during those years. I think that the financial crisis was not a small turn of the business cycle. I think it had to do with years and years of arterial sclerosis in our economic system as well. I think, like in foreign policy, Obama is now running up against a serious problem, which is that his economic policy staved off, I think you can argue, staved off worse, but it has not made people's lives better. And, in fact, people are getting more desperate. Joblessness is over 10%. Wall Street is healthy again. Now, that's a bad political situation to be in. You have bailed out the banks, and they're now doling out bonuses, in some cases that are record bonuses, while masses of Americans cannot find work and are going to start wondering, what is the president doing for me? So if I were Obama's political advisors, I would have him talking about jobs and incomes as much as possible. Unfortunately, there's not much a president can do other than create a WPA, which is not in the cards. But I think Obama has a political problem where this is concerned, and there's a chance that the midterm elections could go rather badly for his party. So just as his foreign policy is running up against realities, I think his economic policy is also doing the same thing. Yes, sir.
This question doesn't align exactly with your remarks, but it's sort of the question of the day. What should Obama decide about Afghanistan?
That's the question I was hoping no one would ask. Well, we're all sort of watching a very interesting process. We don't quite know what's going on, but we know something's going on. It's a very public-private discussion. And very unusual for this White House. A lot of it is being leaked. This is, you know, a watertight White House. But because there's now a division on Afghanistan that is partly a division between his military advisors and his political advisors, they're leaking and counter-leaking in order to gain advantage. And what it's doing is giving the public the sense that the president doesn't really know what to do. I think something else is going on. I think Obama is holding all these meetings, hours and hours and hours of meetings, because for the first time he's really informing himself about this war. He issued a strategy in March that was not based on deep knowledge. He hadn't had time. But now I think he's woken up to the fact that this war could break his presidency, and he wants to be sure he gets it right. And so he's learning at a level of detail down to the province, you know, down to the even the district in Afghanistan, that his predecessor would never have interested himself in. I think he's doing what presidents should do. They should master detail before they come up with policy. They should not act on gut judgments in matters as serious as war. And they should question the assumptions of their military leaders. But all that said, I still think he's stuck, because I don't think he thinks he can get out. But I also don't think that he has the time, the political support, or even the resources to have a chance to really turn it around. 8 years have gone by. It's very late in the day in this war. He was dealt a very bad hand. And I don't know how he's going to turn it around. We also have a terrible partner in Kabul. And you can't. This is not something Americans can impose on Afghans. It's part of one of the themes of my book, is the stubbornness of local reality. Afghanistan has very stubborn realities. And although it's capable of changing, and I think Afghanistan actually has changed a lot since 2001, American neglect and Afghan bad leadership have given the Taliban a second chance. And my guess is Obama will come up with a kind of a middle way and maybe 25 or 30,000 more troops, but it's not going to be the solution. But because we've had this waiting period with the country and the world, you know, hanging on, wondering what's going to be the answer, there will be a huge anticlimax when he comes out with a strategy that doesn't look that different from the current one, and that anticlimax will deflate confidence even more. I think he's losing public confidence, and it's a dangerous situation for a president, you know, who's trying to fight a war. I think the lady over here had a question. Yep. And then
this is a follow-up to the earlier question. Some Democratic presidents like Jimmy Carter and Clinton were at odds with the American military. And I wondered, the American military has changed a great deal over the years, and I just wonder what is the relationship and the degree of respect between the military, especially in their attitude toward President Obama?
That's a great question. You're absolutely right. Ever since Vietnam, there's been a kind of cultural war between Democratic politicians and the military. And that has, you know, a lot of historical reasons behind it. I've only been out in the field once since Obama, actually twice, but once an extended stay with troops since Obama was elected. So I don't have a lot of field work to back up my answer. But one thing that's happened in the last few years is the military has really wised up. More than any other institution, they learned from their mistakes in Iraq and began to change. In fact, they may be the only institution that really adapted, and that's because it's life or death for them. I mean, they're right on the tip of the spear. And the adaptation they made was to become more sophisticated about where they are and who they're with and how to fight. And in a nutshell, they moved from a find the enemy and kill him attitude to a get to know the local population and find out what they want. And the level of intellectual sophistication among lieutenants and sergeants and captains is just amazing to me, and really one of the few hopeful things that's come out of the Iraq war, and it's been now been transferred to Afghanistan. So, and those qualities make them a little less likely to despise Democratic politicians, because it's the language that you hear from human rights groups, from development organizations, from democracy promotion groups. That language has become the language of counterinsurgency, which is now the lingua franca of the Army and the Marine Corps. And it's a language that, you know, relies on anthropology, on political science, on economics, as much as on war fighting. So I think the gap between the warrior and the intellectual, or between the liberal and the Army, has begun to close. And I don't think Obama is as mistrusted as Bill Clinton was. And he also doesn't carry some of the baggage that Bill Clinton carried. Yes, in the middle. Hmm? One more question? Yeah, in the middle here.
Thanks. This is more of a production sort of question. When you created this, or when you put together this collection, how did you decide upon which articles to include, and when did you decide to put it all together?
That's a question I like a lot better than the Afghanistan question. I began to think about it after Obama's election, when I had, again, I had this sense of looking backward already, as if something had passed, as if we were now entering something new. And I realized that a lot of the work I've done since 9/11 is a kind of a running picture of America during those years. The collection is divided into four parts. The first part is a series of essays that begin with the morning of 9/11 and end with the last years of the Iraq War, or the most recent years of the Iraq War. There's a gap in there because my book, The Assassin's Gate, was about the Iraq War, and I didn't want to duplicate that material. So there's kind of a jump from before the Iraq War to the later years. But that's a whole section of essays on war on terrorism, Iraq, and how the country responded to 9/11. The second section is about these less well-traveled, well-known countries like Burma, like Nigeria, like Ivory Coast. So it's a series of long narrative pieces, travel pieces kind of the kind that I read from. The third is about writers and books. Actually, I think one of the the essays I like best in this collection is about how Ernest Hemingway and John Dos Passos and George Orwell all met each other in Spain during the Spanish Civil War and the kind of betrayals that went on between them. And it's about what happens when writers get mixed up with war and politics. And there are some obvious lessons for our own time. So the third part is about writers and war. And the fourth part is about last year's presidential campaign. And it ends with the election of Barack Obama. So it has a kind of chronological arc to it. But each section has its own, you know, thematic unity as well. I've never put out a collection before. You know, I hesitated to do so because it's not new material, although there's an introduction that's new. But I think it's valuable simply to remember what it was like to be alive, to be thinking, to be in the world during those incredibly tumultuous years. And that's what I hope Interesting Times allows you to remember. And I think it's on sale outside, which was one reason I came here, although not the only reason. So thanks so much for your attention.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.